friends, it's Rod here with my introduction to this week's podcast episode. This week is our second week on Psalms of New Orientation, and this week is a festival of Psalm 73. So Psalm 73 was the psalm that we focused on Sunday, but it's also the psalm that Merrill is going to talk about in her five-minute Merrill. So you've got Psalm 73 times two today. We're going to start with Stu reading the psalm, and then it will be my homily, and then we will have Merrill doing her five-minute Merrill. This week, right at the end, I decided to cut out and then put at the end the conversation that we had as a community, so different people's voices. I know a few people have said that they really like to hear those voices and it makes them feel connected. So I thought if I put them at the end, then those people can listen to them. And if you don't have the time for that and you just wanted to listen to the homily and to Merrill and to the psalm itself, then you can just stop at the end of Merrill. The other thing is that I end my homily with a practice, a meditative practice by James Finley, who is one of the staff at the Center for Action and Contemplation, which is Richard Rohr's center in New Mexico. So you might like to pause at the end of my preparation for that practice and take as long as you like to do the practice before you listen to Merrill, or you might like to just do it at another time or not do it at all. The last thing is that at the end of the practice, I played A Blessing by John O'Donohue, which I've cut out because we don't have permission to put it on our podcast, but I will post a link on Facebook to that reading of the blessing. It's a beautiful reading of a blessing that he read on Being when he was interviewed on Being a number of years ago. So that's probably enough from me by way of introduction. I hope you're all going well. I hope that you are coping okay with lockdown 2.0, and by the time you listen to this, we will probably be in mandatory mask time, so I hope you're wearing masks when you go out to avoid a $200 fine and to protect the vulnerable. So blessings, and I will hand over to the very lovely Stu. Thanks, Stu.
I'm going to read Psalm 73 from the Inclusive Bible. Israel, how good your God is to those who are single-hearted. My feet had almost strayed, a little farther and I would have slipped, for I had envied those who boast of their success and begrudged the prosperity of the corrupt. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They don't suffer as others do. They're not afflicted like the rest of humanity. So pride is their badge of honor. Violence is their robe that covers them. Their eyes gorge themselves on new luxuries. Their taste for extravagance knows no limits. They cynically attribute evil to God and blame all oppression on the Most High. They think their mouth speaks from heaven, for their tongue can dictate on earth. This is why my people turn to them and lap up all they say, asking, how will God ever find out? Does the Most High know everything? Look at them. These are the corrupt, yet they're well off and still getting richer. What's the use of keeping my own heart pure and washing my hands in innocence, if God still plagues me all day long and brings new punishments every morning? Had I dared to say things like that, I would have been false to the circle of your disciples. Instead, I sought to probe the problem of injustice, but found it nearly impossible, until the day I entered God's sanctuary and saw the end in store for them. They'll certainly fall into perdition. You urge them on to their own destruction, until they suddenly fall, done for, terrified to death. Like waking up from a dream, Yahweh, their fantasies will be dashed in an instant. But since my heart was aggrieved and I had a gutful of anger, I became a stupid fool before you. I acted like a jackass, and I'm sorry. Even so, you were always at my side, holding me by the hand. Now leave me with your counsel, and in the end, bring me into your glory. I look to no one else in heaven. I delight in nothing else on earth. My body and mind may fail, and my heart may pine for love, but God is my heart's rock and my portion forever. So then, those who are far from you will be lost, and you will destroy those who break faith with you. But as for me, my joy lies in being close to God. I have taken refuge in you, Yahweh, my sovereign, proclaiming without end what you have done.
Before I share some things, I just wanted to remind you, as Shane mentioned this last week, just wanted to remind you that at the end of this series, we are going to, or perhaps just in a few weeks actually, we're going to get people to share things about Psalms of orientation, things about Psalms of disorientation, and things about Psalms of new orientation that they want to hold on to. We've looked at the three types of Psalms separately, but we want to just mine those different Psalms for things that we can carry forward as a community. So, keep reflecting on that, reflecting on the last 8 or 9 weeks as we've looked at these different kinds of Psalms, and what are some things that you've taken from some of those weeks and some of the Psalms that we've read that you might want to share with the community, or you might want to carry with you as we move on as a community. So keep reflecting on that. So I think the thing I like about this psalm, well, this is, I guess, something that I've perhaps projected from my own experience onto the psalm, but that it does in many ways reflect my own journey from orientation through disorientation to new orientation. I grew up with what Jenny was talking about. I guess I grew up with that form of a transactional view of God, where basically I saw my luck as blessing. So I thought, I'm blessed, I've got all of these things in my life because I've been good or because I've been obedient. God is powerful and loving, and so if I do the right thing, then I'll be rewarded. It's the logic in the book of Job that Job's comforters bring. If you are blessed, if your life is good, that means you're a good person and you're doing the right thing. And if you're not, if your life is full of tragedy and loss, that must mean that you've done something wrong. And this is what God rejects in the book of Job, and this is what Jesus rejects in the Gospels on numerous occasions when the disciples are saying, this person's blind, whose fault is that? And God and Jesus says, you've missed the point. But unfortunately, many of us still grow up in churches where that's the message that we get, this transactional view of God, and that luck is equated with blessing and bad luck is equated with having done something wrong. And it sets us up for the kind of rage and grief and confusion that the psalmist experiences in the first half of this psalm. And that certainly happened to me. My life suddenly made it impossible for me to any longer believe in a transactional view of God, because I've told my story before and many know it, but my marriage fell apart, and it fell apart in a way that made a particular mockery of the idea of a transactional God. There were details in the way my marriage ended that made the idea of me following the script and then doing the right thing and being rewarded, it just made such an utter mockery of that. And so I found myself full of confusion and rage, full of a sense of the completely arbitrary nature of life. Those verses 12 to 14. Look at them, these are the corrupt, yet they are well off and still getting richer. What's the use of keeping my own heart pure, washing my hands in innocence, if God still plagues me all day long and brings new punishments every morning? That was the kind of script that was going through my head pretty much every day. And I guess I went from this view of life that God is good and powerful, so my life will be blessed, a kind of naive and triumphant place of orientation, to a place where life seemed arbitrary or worse because the cruel seemed to thrive. So God was either cruel or non-existent. So it was this kind of despairing place of disorientation. And I feel like the faith I grew up with, the church that I grew up in, didn't prepare me for this phase of life at all, for this experience at all. So I guess like the psalmist, I'd reached a kind of fork in the road of my spiritual journey, where I could stay in this deepening place of kind of bitterness and disbelief, or perhaps find a new God, the other side of this God that I was having to let go. There are a lot of writers out there, a lot of spiritual writers, I guess, that talk about this fork in the road, that talk about this experience of disorientation that is is an opportunity for something new and richer, but is also can be the beginning of the death of faith. The Czech, I'm just going to read a couple of these. There's the Czech theologian Thomas Halleck, who wrote this book, Patience with God, and he describes it this way. There are many people who long maintained a childish notion of a magic God, a God of banal consolations and superficial optimism, a guardian angel at our service, an inveterate comforter who tells us everything will turn out all right, a household God intended to fulfill just one single role, working as an infallible granter of our wishes. Cozy little gods like that logically collapse when faced with the first serious crises of our lives. After taking leave of a God of that variety, quite a lot of people, often with a certain pride in discovering the truth about the real world at last, declare themselves to be atheists. Richard Rohr, in his Daily Meditations of July 5th, he talks about spiritual transformation always includes a disconcerting reorientation. It can either help people to find new meaning, or it can force people to close down and slowly turn bitter. The difference is determined precisely by the quality of our inner life, our practices, and our spirituality. Change always happens, but transformation is always a process of letting go, living in the confusing, shadowy space for a while. So for the psalmist in Psalm 73, something happened. We don't know exactly what it was, but something did happen for them to turn their disorientation into transformation. Something led them back to God, but a different God. For the psalmist, it seems to have been a sudden encounter in the temple, and Merrill talks about this in her five-minute Merrill on Psalm 73. Now, it's true, as Stu and Amy, Stuart and Amy pointed out, it's true that the deeper reality that the psalmist encounters here is still couched in the language of retribution and violence. I guess for us, as Merrill said last week, I don't think we have to identify with this language to identify with the experience that the psalmist is having. An encounter with a bigger, deeper God, a bigger, deeper reality. The emergence of a way forward out of disorientation and doubt, a sense that justice and love have not been defeated. I guess my sense is that this is what the psalmist experiences, and then they they drape over that experience the only language that's available to them to make sense of it, which is the language of transaction and retribution. So it sounds like they're going in a full circle back to the place that they started of this transactional God. But my sense from phrases like the one that that Josh pointed out, you know, this idea of God holding the psalmist by the hand, my sense is that what we're seeing here is an encounter with a different kind of God, not the same transactional God, but a God of solidarity, and a God who, even when life is not arbitrary, but is consistent in love. And this happened to me too. It wasn't a sudden encounter with God in the sanctuary, but it was slowly through encounters with people who had had similar experiences of disorientation and had been transformed by it. Theologians like Frank Tupper, he's one of my favourites, who he lost his wife to cancer when she was very young, and the process of reflection and grief that followed this led him to the conclusion that life is indeed arbitrary, but that God is not. And the mystic James Finley, who says that love protects us from nothing, even as it sustains us in all things. Love protects us from nothing, even as it sustains us in all things. Even last week, listening to Meryl, it was the same kind of experience for me, hearing her attachment to God despite such deep experiences of disorientation and loss renewed my hope and trust that the same could be true for me. And I guess this is my prayer for our community. My prayer for our community is that it may be a place where people who are in deep places of disorientation, whose God has collapsed in the face of loss and doubt, that people like that can find a way through to hope and a bigger sense of God rather than being abandoned to bitterness and contempt for God. That this will be a place where people present their experiences of new orientation in ways that don't feel condemning or violent to those who are in a place of disorientation. A place where people are not blamed for their doubt and pain and then abandoned to it, but where others walk alongside them, understanding and affirming the reality of their feelings of abandonment and confusion. I think this is a bit of the danger in that quote I read from Thomas Halleck, and even in the Richard Rohr quote, that it can become victim blaming, where the reason why your experience of grief and loss turned you into an atheist is because you lacked the practices or the spiritual resources to carry through to the other side and to learn the lessons of your experience. I think that can be quite a violent way of framing it, because you're then responsible for your own resilience. But my hope is that this community can be a place where we carry each other in those moments. It's not survival of the fittest or survival of the most resilient, but when we see another person struggling to hold on to any form of faith in an experience of meaninglessness and absurdity and abandonment, we don't just wish them luck, but we walk alongside them to try to be God's hands and God's voice for them when they cannot feel or hear God at all. And I guess I say all this out of self-interest, really, because I know that life is going to wound me deeply again. There's no such thing as a life that doesn't involve deep, deep wounding and confusion. And when I next feel abandoned by God, I'm going to need other people around me. I'm going to need wise, kind, and gentle people to be God to me in that moment when I can't feel God myself. So. That's my self-interested reason for trying to be a part of a community and play a role in creating a community where we can be around each other like that in those moments. I had lots of other things to say, but I'm going to leave it there. But just a couple of teasers, I guess. One thing I listened to this week was an interview with Hilary McBride, who's a psychotherapist from Canada. And she talked about the way that through therapy and through personal work, we can start to be the kind, gentle, wise person that we need for ourselves and for our own bodies. We can stay with our hurt, be rigorously compassionate to ourselves, teach our bodies that we ourselves are safe. She said, there's this beautiful quote, she said, we need to say to our bodies, whatever is happening out there, we will be together and I will always be kind to you. So there are ways in which we can be the people that we need ourselves, but there's also ways in which we need to be it to each other. I also had this very long analogy, which I might come back to, about us being a vineyard together, some of us being pruned and some of us being fruitful, but despite these differences, having a unity in our slowly deepening roots, sinking into the steadfast love of God. But I won't impose that extended metaphor on you today. Instead of more talk, I thought maybe we could finish with a silent practice, because I think, as Richard Rohr said, cultivating spiritual practices is also central to finding our way back to God after a dark night of the soul. So this is also from Richard Rohr. Sorry, I'm a bit of a fanboy, but it's not his practice. It's James Finley's practice, who I quoted before. So I'm just going to read it, and then give us 2 minutes of silence where you can do the practice, or you can just sit in silence if you like. So James Finley says that a practice is any act habitually entered into with our whole heart that takes us to the deeper place. Some of these practices we might not think of as prayer and meditation. Tending the roses, a long, slow walk to no place in particular, a quiet moment at day's end, being vulnerable in the presence of that person in whose presence we're taken to the deeper place, the pause between two lines of a poem. There are these acts that reground us in the depth dimension of our life that matter most. So if we're faithful to our practice, our practice will be faithful to us. So in this particular contemplative practice, sit and renew your awareness that you're sitting in the presence of God all about you and within you. As you inhale God's silent, "I love you," in which God is being poured out and utterly given away to you as the miracle of your very life. Then when you exhale yourself in love, "I love you." And so we are breathing along with God. "I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you." From the reciprocity of love, destiny is fulfilled and the foundations of suffering are healed. So just for 2 minutes now, let's do this practice. Inhaling the love of God and exhaling love to God. Hi, it's Monday Rod again, just interrupting Sunday Rod to remind you that this is the point where you can pause if you want and do that meditative practice, or you could just roll on and listen to Meryl talk about Psalm 73. So over to Meryl.
Hi again, everyone. So second week on looking at Psalms of reorientation. I was thinking, well, you could probably say that all Psalms are some ways Psalms of new orientation, because even putting the chaos into poetic words begins a reflection that takes us into new orientation. However, there are certain Psalms that quite deliberately reflect on the journey that has been. They go forward by looking backwards. Some of the typical language of these might be, "Sing a new song to the Lord because," and the because looks back at what has happened and reflects on where they've come to now since that time of disorientation. Songs of new orientation can only be uttered after the crisis is over and there's enough distance to reflect, but they still embody, remember the pain of whatever that crisis was. There's one psalm, though, that I want to look at today in particular that I think quite deliberately takes us on a theological reflective journey, and it's Psalm 73. Walter Brueggemann, there's that name again, once said that he thinks Psalm 73 is the centre point of the Book of Psalms, because it's in the middle of this that there's a kind of aha moment where there's a whole new way of seeing the world, which takes the prayer from the kind of raging against what's been going on to imagining the world in a quite different way. The wonderful Jewish scholar and mystic Martin Buber once called this psalm a meditation of the heart, because the word heart pops up five or six times on the way through, and it takes us on quite a journey. We start off with the psalmist saying, "Truly God is good to the upright, to those who are pure in heart," as a kind of, you know, learned mantra, this is what I should say, and then straight into, but as for me, what a load of crap. I look around and I see that the people who are doing well are the wicked, whereas me, their hearts overflow with follies. They're fat with all the good things that they have, and it's not fair. For me, I've kept my heart clean all in vain. I've been innocent. I've done the right thing. And I've got nothing. But then after this spill out of anger at the unfairness of life, there's a moment where the psalmist stops. And I think this is incredibly important. Verse 15, "If I had said I will talk on in this way, I would have been untrue to the circle of your children." There's a sense where suddenly this person becomes aware that they're not alone, and by doing nothing but spill out bitterness and anger and sense of injustice, they're actually damaging other people as well, and that there is actually some sort of responsibility for us to get our shit together, get our theology, work through it, not necessarily sorted, but at least good solid, get our teeth into what's going on for the sake of others as well as ourselves. And there's a real turning point at this stage. And the centre point is a couple of verses later. He's saying, I tried to understand it, but it just seemed too hard. How do I even work all this out? Until I went into the sanctuary of God. And there's a still centre here. And it's as if in the sanctuary, in that sense of being in God's presence, they come into a sense of realisation of what's real and what's not. And the imagery here takes us back to Psalm 1. What has deep roots and what gets blown away like chaff before the wind, because it actually has no roots. And he has this suggestion of those whose lives are particularly given over to simply to their own pleasure as people in slippery places, how they're destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. They're like a dream when one awakes. And I'm thinking of T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men, the stuffed men, the hollow men, people who live entirely out of a persona and are not real. And the psalmist goes on to look back and say, "When my soul was embittered and I was pricked in heart, I was pricked in heart, I was like a brute beast." And then goes on to say that the one thing that I have that can never be taken away from me is in fact the presence of God. "There is nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." And so it ends up with a, truly, those who are far from you will perish. And it's that truly that we started out with. But now there's a sense that the psalmist knows what truly means and knows what perishing means. That there is something about finding that deep, deep reality of being seen in the presence of God as who we fully are, rather than living out of the persona. It's a wonderful psalm. There's some of the language in it people have trouble with. It seems a little bit judgmental, a little bit like, God's going to blow down all those people who aren't his people. But I don't think that's how it's meant to be. I think it really is just inviting us to look carefully at what is giving us depth, where our roots are going down, and also just that importance of reflecting on what's going on around us so that, okay, those people are still getting all the goodies, I might still be not having very much at all, but does that actually reflect the deeper reality of what my internal life is doing? Anyway, have a read of Psalm 73 and see what you think about the new orientation that comes through there. Bye.
So one last interruption from me, Monday Rod, to say I hope you enjoyed that. Some fantastic reflections from Meryl. We've just got such richness from her in this series. And as promised, now I am going to hand over to the community. These are the community reflections and questions about Psalm 73. You'll notice that there are some comments that I actually refer to in my homily, so that's a bit back to front, but listening to this might help to make sense of some of the things that I refer to in my homily. Obviously, if you don't have the time to listen to the meanderings of our community, you can finish here, but I hope you have a wonderful week and hope to see you soon. Bye. So a chance now for anyone that would like to share any reflections, things that they notice about this psalm, questions that they have about this psalm, things that they wonder. So over to you. Anything that you want to share or wonder? Just unmute yourself.
Do you know who he's talking about when he talks about people who boast of their successes? Like, does that actually mean what it says, or is he talking about something else?
Good question. I mean, I think he's talking about the corrupt, generally, the corrupt, the violent, and that kind of. So it's not just successful people, but I think it's people whose success is based on corruption and violence, that kind of thing. Any other questions that people had?
Mine is less of a question, just like a reflection of it's so filled with quite full-on language and, you know, had a gut full of anger and all that. And then verse 23, even so you are always at my side holding me by the hand, is such like an innocent little image. It kind of, I really like that. Those two positioned next to each other like that, or just such enraged language and then almost such a gentle ending. Yeah.
I thought it was quite interesting, they, in the first verse, that kind of equation of health with success and pride. I think that's something that is quite prevalent in our modern world as well, like all of those like Insta fitness gurus and stuff who are just kind of often just lucky enough to have good genes rather than actually having an understanding of all the complexities of health and what that means. I think it's really interesting that that's in there, that they're somehow in that world of corruption, he's also pinpointed people who are living like as if everyone else who doesn't have good health has brought it upon themselves. Yeah.
Just to dovetail off that, I think one of my favourite pieces of writing by Anne Patchett is when she talks about the trouble with people who have extraordinary luck is that they like to equate it to personal goodness.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was written by a rich person and saying, yeah, we are bad and yeah, we do all these things, but look, this is what's going to happen to us in the future. That way the peasants don't revolt at the current time.
Yeah, I was just thinking how relatable it is now, just the difference between the rich and the poor and the people who are willing to do whatever to other people to get ahead, and those who are trodden underfoot. That's like nothing's changed really. It's gone from feudalism to capitalism, but it's still the same story. And I'm sure a lot of people here and those who've been involved in social justice causes have felt that same rage. And the resolution that it's kind of okay because they'll suffer in the end times. That's like, I can sort of see where you're coming from, Stuart, is that it's like it's a bit of a cold comfort. Like, is it enough that you know, there's some, what's the opposite of pie in the sky? Punishment at an undetermined future time, when like that can't be an excuse to not pursue change now. And I don't think that's what this psalm's saying, but yeah, that's a problem that I've had in the past with the sort of theology that says, don't worry about what's happening on earth, because there's going to be judgment at the end. It's like, that's not enough. But yeah, just the anger in this psalm at injustice is actually really encouraging to see that in the psalms.
Somehow, I don't think they were French, because they would have had a revolution otherwise.
I'm muted. Any final comments?
I find it problematic to think about it, because I know that while I don't have a job or a direct link to benefiting from oppression, I still feel very embroiled and very much a part of that system that I know I'm benefiting from. And I find it really hard to just like to think that I'm not the person that he might be talking about.
Yeah,
that guilt, or like that feeling that somehow I'm one of the people who he might be alluding to.
We're not gonna directly address that question today. Well, I'm not going to, but I think it's such a great question, and I think that one of the mistakes that privileged people have made consistently throughout history is to identify with the wrong people in the Bible, to think that they are the righteous ones looking at the corrupt and the evil and going, oh, lucky I'm not like them, whereas in actual fact, the Bible is a critique of their privilege and a calling them to repentance. And I think that's exactly what Jesus is talking about in the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, where the Pharisee says, thank you, God, that I'm not like that guy there. And the tax collector just repents. And Jesus said, that's the way to be good with God, repentance, not self-justification. So I think you're absolutely right. And if we read a a psalm like this, thinking, identifying in some simple-minded way with the psalmist rather than the people that the psalmist is critiquing, then that's very dangerous for people of privilege.